You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 282, Exodus 17, part 1. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, what's going on?
Well, we've managed to split Exodus 17 into two parts, so here we go again.
Hey, that's okay. We expected this.
Just can't help myself.
We expected this. This is your wheelhouse.
So. Did you?
Yes.
Did you really?
Yes. I think we did. Oh, when we all voted it, we knew there goes 2019, and we were correct.
Yeah, I know. My wife asked me this morning, how long are you going to be in Exodus yet? You know, it should be about done. I just looked at her and said, we're going to be in Exodus the rest of the year. I'm sorry. But
hey, it's okay. We knew what we were getting into. And we already know what we're going to do after. Usually after we do a book, we have several topics that we touch on and whatnot. So we already have those planned out. And let me tell you, you're going to want to stick around for those because they're going to be really good. I can't spill the beans on that, but
I'm looking forward to that. It'll be fun.
I mean, Exodus is just good stuff all over. So I know nobody's complaining. Trust me. Nobody's complaining.
Yeah. I mean, it is good stuff. You know, there's just a lot in here. And I don't want to, sound like a broken record here, but there's just a lot in here that's easy to read over. That really, I never really thought about that before, or never really factored that into something else, that might be more familiar. We hit that last time, just in chapter 16, but here we go again. We're going to have the same issue here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read the whole chapter. And since I've already telegraphed, this is going to be broken into two parts. The first part, where we're going to camp today, is the first seven verses, the water from the rock episode. And, I really toyed about doing the whole chapter. And I thought, if I do that, we're going to have to split it up anyway, because 8 through 16, Exodus 17, verse 8 through the end of the chapter, is the Amalekite incident. And that's going to take us into some real unseen realm territory. But actually, to a depth and adding content elements that I did not cover in the book. So that's going to be sort of one of those expanding episodes where we expand on certain things in the book. So I just figured, we're going to have to do it anyway. We're going to take that off. We're going to make it its own episode, but I'm going to read through the whole chapter just so that you can get what we're doing today. And then you get a preview of what part two is going to be about. And by the time we wrap up today, I'll also sort of telegraph a bit more of what part two is going to be about. And some of you might, even as we read through it right now, will sort of pick up on it. But for those who don't, I'll telegraph it. It's going to be good stuff. So here we are, Exodus 17. I'm again reading from ESV. All the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and the people grumbled against Moses and said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried to the Lord, "What shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me." And the Lord said to Moses, "Pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, because they tested the Lord by saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Let me just stop there. We hit a few things. There was a reference to the elders of Israel, and you say, well, that's kind of weird because we're only going to get the elders in the next chapter. That's true, but we've already seen, Exodus doesn't follow strict chronology. It was composed at different times. We also got a reference to Horeb, which we saw earlier in our episodes on the location of Mount Sinai, that's another name for Sinai. We're going to get into that big time here. That's really what our focus this episode, this part of Exodus 17 is going to be. But if we keep reading, here's what we get. This is verse 8 now, to the end of the chapter. Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, "Choose for us men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek, while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed, and whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew weary, so they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, while Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side. So his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven." And Moses built an altar and called the name of it, "The Lord is my banner," saying, "A hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." Now that's the end of the chapter. And again, I don't want to telegraph too much now because I'm going to do that at the end of this episode. But the reference to Amalek is really, you know, important. It's going to take us down a number of roads here and some of the language used elsewhere in this section. Now, the part about Moses raising his hands, if you remember the episode that we did about Elim and the terebinths there, the 12 and the 70 and all that imagery, we alluded to this episode about, well, maybe the staff of Moses, since it's wood, it came from a tree, is emblematic of the tree of God, or, you know, divine encounter, maybe even Eden, you know, because all the, there's a reason why trees were put at places of divine encounter, or divine encounter occurred at places where there were trees, because of the cosmic garden, the cosmic mountain imagery that takes our minds back to Eden. So we talked about that a little bit. I'm not going to spend much time on that next week. I'm going to spend most of the time, really, you know, practically all the time, on the issue of who is Amalek and how that bleeds into some other passages. But when we get to the end of this episode, I'll telegraph that a little bit more. So for our purposes here, we want to, you know, get into the first seven verses. And the first thing we sort of run into here, you know, it doesn't sound like much. I mean, this is easy sermonic material, you know, trust God, so on and so forth, and all that's true. And it would be good sermonic material. But the reference to Rephidim and Meribah and Massah are actually really important. They're going to dovetail with some things that we've talked about earlier. So Rephidim, I'm going to read you a little bit from the Anchor Bible Dictionary on Rephidim. And I think that'll, you know, sort of, again, telegraph for us what we're going to be talking about. So the entry in ABD, Anchor Bible Dictionary, says this: Rephidim, a station of the Exodus located between the wilderness of Sin and the wilderness of Sinai, according to Exodus 17, 1 and 8, Exodus 19, 2, and Numbers 33, 14, and 15. So let me just read Exodus 19, 2, just so that you have that in your head. They set out from Rephidim and came into the wilderness of Sinai, and they encamped in the wilderness. There Israel encamped before the mountain. And Numbers 13, 14, and 15, they set out from Alush and camped at Rephidim, where there was no water for the people to drink. And they set out from Rephidim and camped in the wilderness of Sinai. So you get the impression that Rephidim and Sinai are somewhat close. You know, we don't have measurements or anything like that in here, but, you know, we kind of get that impression. Let me back to ABD. The next sentence says, Dophka and Alush are also mentioned as encampments between the wilderness of Sin and Rephidim. The location of Rephidim is unknown and dependent upon the identification of Mount Sinai. Various proposals have been made following a northern route of the Exodus, placing Mount Sinai and thus Rephidim in the Negev highlands, the North Sinai, or the land of Midian. Those opting for a southern Exodus route locate Rephidim in the vicinity of Jebel Musa, close to the southern tip of the peninsula. Now, me just stop there. In Jebel Musa, that's the traditional site of Sinai, way down in the V, you know, that's formed between the two forks of the Red Sea. And the other ones are, of course, you know, further north, a variety of situations. But the key point at this point is to note that Rephidim, again, has some proximity to Sinai, to Mount Sinai. Now, three significant events occur while Israel is situated at Rephidim. The Israelites complain of being in a place where, quote, there was no water for the people to drink, unquote. So Moses is instructed to provide water by smiting the rock. Rephidim became known as Massah, which means testing, and Meribah, which means contention, because Israel determined to test the Lord to see if he was among them or not. Again, we just read that. The term Massah is used several other times in warnings to Israel not to prove or test the Lord as they did at Rephidim. And those references would include Deuteronomy 6:16, Deuteronomy 9:22, and we've got Deuteronomy 33:8. So basically, just don't do this like you did at, you know, Rephidim. Now, here is an important component. Meribah, okay, that term that we just read in Exodus 17 that's associated with Rephidim, the incident at Rephidim. Meribah also refers to an incident near Kadesh Barnea, involving a challenge to Moses to provide water. Okay, that's Numbers 20, verse 13, Numbers 20, 24, Numbers 27, 14, Deuteronomy 32, 51, and Psalm 81, 7. And we also get Meribah mentioned in Deuteronomy 33, 1 and 2. I'm going to turn there in a second. But again, here's what you need to be tracking on. Rephidim. There's some proximity between Rephidim and Mount Sinai. Okay? There's also some proximity between Rephidim and Kadesh. Okay? Again, I should just read a couple numbers. Which ones do I want to go to here? Well, you know what? I'm going to hold off because I'll get into a fuller discussion here about the Kadesh specifically. Let's go to Deuteronomy 33, 1 and 2. Here's where else, but this isn't going to be as obvious in translation, where else this occurs. So Deuteronomy 33, I'm going to start with ESV, and here's what it says. I actually did discuss this passage in Unseen Realm in the section about divine counsel presence at the giving of the law. Okay, so here's Deuteronomy 33, verse 1. This is the blessing with which Moses, the man of God, blessed the people of Israel before his death. He said, "The Lord came from Sinai and dawned from Seir upon us. He shone forth from Mount Paran." Let me stop there. Now, here we're back in the march from the south passages. And earlier when we talked about the location of Sinai, I said you must account for the march from the south. And that's part of how to locate Sinai, and it's actually significant trouble for the view that Sinai is in Midian. Okay, if you can go back and listen to those episodes. But here we are again. This is one of those passages. The Lord came from Sinai and dawned from Seir upon us. He shone forth from Mount Paran. Here's the next line. He came from the 10,000s of holy ones with flaming fire at his hand, which is really odd. That's ESV. Yes, he loved his people, verse 3, all his holy ones were in his hand. That's also really odd. So they followed in your footsteps, receiving direction from you. Now, if you read Unseen Realm, you will know that there are a number of textual issues in Deuteronomy 33. And I took people to the Septuagint and compared the Masoretic text, the traditional text, with the Septuagint. Because this passage is really behind the New Testament idea, which is stated in three or four passages about the law being dispensed or delivered through or by angels, okay? And it's not really clear in ESV, because ESV is following the Masoretic text, basically. Septuagint, it gets a little clearer, and I'll turn there in a second. But if I switch versions here and go to the Tanakh, this is the Jewish Publication Society English translation of the same passage, Deuteronomy 33. This is what it says. It translates the Masoretic text a little bit differently than ESV does. "This is the blessing with which Moses, the man of God, bade the Israelites farewell before he died. He said, The Lord came from Sinai. He shone upon them from Seir. He appeared from Mount Paran and approached from Rivavot Kodesh. It transliterates that term. Doesn't translate it, it transliterates it. Lightning flashing at them from his right. Lover indeed of the people, their hallowed something are all in your hand. You know, again, that's awkward too. They followed in your steps, accepting your pronouncements. Now, the Hebrew text reads, either translated from Rivavot Kodesh or going back to the ESV, where it says, from the 10,000s of holy ones. The Hebrew text actually says Meribot Kodesh. Meribot. Meribot is the construct form, if you've had a little Hebrew, you know that the A-H ending of a feminine noun, and geographical nouns are typically feminine, changes to a T when it's linked to a following noun. So Meribot Kodesh is the word Meribah, which is associated with Rephidim in Exodus 17, followed by the place name Kodesh. It's really kind of odd. And you can see, again, why, you know, there's a problem. Now, if you go to the Masoretic text, the Kodesh part is pointed, the vowels put in it are pointed to spell Kodesh, which is like holy or holiness or something like that. But the Septuagint, and I'm going to click over to Unseen Realm here because I discussed this in Unseen Realm. The translator of Unseen Realm didn't take those consonants that way. Or excuse me, the translator of the Septuagint that I refer to in Unseen Realm did not take the consonants that way. I'm going to click out to Unseen Realm. This is on page 164. That's where it begins. And this is part of the discussion of the law being dispensed by angels and whatnot. And I put Deuteronomy 33, 1 through 4 into two columns. Left column was the traditional Masoretic text. And the right column is the Septuagint. Here's what the Septuagint says. The Lord has come from Sinai, and he appeared to us from Seir. He made haste from Mount Paran with 10,000s of or from Kadesh, K-A-D-E-S-H, the place name, at his right hand, his angels with him. And in Unseen Realm, I talked about how the Septuagint, since it has angels with him at Kadesh, which is also right there in the verse, you know, it's connected with Sinai, how the Septuagint is really kind of the pool from which Paul in Galatians and the writer of Hebrews and, you know, some other plot passages in the New Testament where they get this idea, this connection between the law being delivered and having an angelic presence there. And this is a very clear New Testament idea. And so the question I'm addressing in Unseen Realm at this point is, where does the idea come from? And you know, you can go back and look at the discussion there. And if you wanted to look at the New Testament references, you'd go to Acts 7, 52 and 53, and Hebrews 2, 1 and 2, Galatians 3, 19. Again, this is a very clear New Testament idea that the law was delivered or dispensed by or, you know, somehow mediated by or in some way connected with the event of the giving of the law. There's angels, there's a divine council presence. Okay, you can go back and read that. But what I want you to notice here is that there were some translations, namely the Septuagint, that took the Hebrew and saw a place name there, Kodesh. And if you looked again at the Hebrew underlying that, you could see how they could do that with the vowels. You could also see prior to that the word Meribah in construct, to use Hebrew grammar lingo, Meribot Kodesh. So Deuteronomy 33, these first few verses, which are clearly associated with Sinai, this is Yahweh coming from the south. Yahweh, the Lord came from Sinai, dawn from Seir, connects Sinai and Seir and Mount Paran, and now Kodesh. Okay, just hold that in your lap for a little bit, because what we're going to establish here, or at least illustrate, is that Rephidim, which is the passage in the first seven, you know, verses of Exodus that we just read, where this incident with the water of the rock comes from. It is associated geographically. It has proximity to Mount Sinai, which would make sense given Deuteronomy 33, and again with the way the Septuagint translator took the text, and other passages as well. So we have Rephidim and Sinai being part of the same regional context, and if Rephidim is part of that context, and Sinai and Kadesh. Well, so are Meribah and Massah. Again, so we've got a number of place names here that are all, again, part of the same regional context. And this is actually going to produce another problem for Mount Sinai being at Midian, because Kadesh is known. The location there is known. And so are Seir and Paran. These places are known, you know, just the area, at least generally. And so we're right back, you know, into that topic that we had discussed, you know, weeks ago about the location of Sinai. And here we have Exodus 17 contributing to the problem. Now, I'm going to go to Anchor Bible Dictionary again, and this is the entry on Massah and Meribah. It has those two places have their own entry. It says this: literally, the terms mean testing and strife. This is the site of an Israelite rebellion during the desert wandering, Exodus 17:7. The precise location is unknown, since the Eloist, again, Anchor Bible Dictionary has taken the JEDP view of the Torah. Since one, you know, places it at Horeb and near Rephidim in Exodus 17. Both of those, again, are equally unknown locations. So Horeb, again, is Sinai. Nobody knows, how do you determine exactly where Sinai is? Again, nobody knows that. Rephidim is the same place, same incident. And so Massah and Meribah, again, are part of this whole discussion. Now, they give some cross-references here. I'm going to read these to you. Numbers 20. Verses 13 and 14, just listen to what these passages say. This is about Edom, okay? Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. Now, right away, that implies that the two places aren't precisely the same, but they're regionally close. You know, they're in the same area, same region. We're talking regionally here. Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. And Edom, of course, is, you know, associated with Seir and Mount Paran. And those places are in turn connected with Sinai. All right, Mount Sinai. This is the March from the South tradition. If you haven't listened to those early episodes, you need to. So he sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. Thus says your brother Israel, you know all the hardship that we have met, how our fathers went down to Egypt, and we lived in Egypt a long time. And the Egyptians dealt harshly with us and our fathers. And when we cried to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel. Isn't that interesting? And brought us out of Egypt. And here we are in Kadesh, a city on the edge of your territory. So again, there's that indication that there's geographical proximity here. Please let us pass through your land, so on and so forth. And of course, then they have a problem. Edom says, no, I'm not going to let you do that. And then there's a conflict there. You know, or at least, you know, it's not a good relationship. Edom refuses. Israel turned away, you know, because, again, there's a relationship there. And so God says, okay, you know. But again, it establishes an adversarial relationship between Edom and Israel. But for our purposes here, the point is that we've got some geographical regional connections between these place names. Numbers 27:14. I'm going to go back up to verse 12. The Lord said to Moses, go up into this mountain of Avarim, and see the land that I have given to the people of Israel. When you have seen it, you also shall be gathered to your people, as your brother Aaron was. So this is right before Moses dies. Because you rebelled against my word in the wilderness of Zin, when the congregation quarreled, failing to uphold me as holy at the waters before their eyes. These are the waters of Meribah of Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. Now, you'll notice how similar that language is. Exodus 17, it was the wilderness of Sin. Okay, we have in Hebrew, let me just go back there. Wilderness of Sin by stages. Now, that in Hebrew is spelled differently. What's translated Sin there is spelled differently with an S letter, as opposed to here, the wilderness of Zin. That is another S letter, but it's a different one. Hebrew has different S's. The first one is Samek. This one is Tsade. Okay, if you know the Hebrew alphabet. So they're nevertheless kind of close, you know, close in terms of name. And we have the same incident going on there that Moses is, there's an incident about water, you know, like not having water. And in one, Exodus 17, that where we're at today, it doesn't say that Moses sinned. It just says he did what God told him to do in the presence of, you know, elders and Aaron and all that, and they went on their way. But at the other one that this refers to, Moses disobeys, has a problem, and then God tells him, look, because of what you did here, you know, you're not going to go into the land of promise. Now, we know these stories, and I don't want to, you know, go too far down the rabbit hole of the stories. Are these two traditions conflated into one or separate? I think you can easily tell, for those who want to see sources in the Torah, they're going to look at these and say, well, they're basically the same, but yet they're not. You know, Moses is punished after one, he's not punished at the other. And so they look at this as two sources converging into one, and the editor not getting them quite exactly right, or, you know, that sort of thing. And other people would say, no, these are two things that happen at the same place at different times. And, you know, we have separate incidents. Regardless of that, what I want you to notice here, if you want to take the view, either view, that they're separate traditions happen at the same place, or they're two different events that happen at the same place at different times, you have Kadesh associated with Meribah here. That's going to become important. Numbers 33, verses 36 to 37, we read again. The Israelites, you know, set out from Jotbathah and camped at Avronah. And they set out from Avronah and camped at Ezion Geber. And they set out from Ezion Geber and camped in the wilderness of Zin. And then in parentheses, it says that is Kadesh. Okay? So again, you have Kadesh being lumped in with these other geographical terms. And the next verse is they set out from Kadesh and camped at Mount Hor on the edge of the land of Edom. Again, right there, it's the same region. Kadesh, Meribah, Rephidim, Massah, okay, and Seir, Paran, Edom. Are you getting the picture here? Mount Sinai is somewhere in the mix of all these place names. It's somewhere in there. All of these places are regionally associated with each other. They're close by. Okay, there's a geographical matrix going on here, that the Israelites are smack dab in this region. And we know where Edom is. We know where this region is. We know where Seir is. We know what that region is. It's kind of a, you know, one, some of them are subsets of others. You know, we know about Edom. We know about Seir. We know about Paran. You know, we know some of these places. And the unknowns like Meribah and Massah and Rephidim, you know, those are the question marks. But we know generally where these things occurred, and therefore we know generally where Sinai should be, and it's not in Midian. That's the point. You can't get Kadesh in Midian. Kadesh is known. So this isn't, on one hand, this doesn't really help locate Sinai with any precision, but it does hurt the Midian view. It makes it just extraordinarily hard with the rest of the March from the South traditions. So here, you know, here we are again. Back to ABD, Anchor Bible Dictionary. The writer says, well, let's look at Psalm. He actually brings a psalm in here. He quotes Ezekiel in a few places that places Massah and Meribah at Kadesh. Again, we don't need to read all of these things. Psalm, let's see. I'm going to go there, 81 here. See if I can find this. Oh, let's see. Go back up to verse 6. Let's go to verse 4. For it is a statute for Israel, a rule for the God of Jacob. He made it a decree in Joseph, and he went out over the land of Egypt. I hear a language I had not known. I relieved your shoulder of the burden. In distress you called, and I delivered you. And these are all references to Joseph going down to Egypt, God delivering Jacob, Israel, okay? In distress you called, I delivered you. I answered you in the secret place of thunder. I tested you at the waters of Meribah. Okay? Hear, O my people, while I admonish you, O Israel, if you would but listen to me. And again, it's a reference to Meribah in association with the secret place of thunder, okay, which would be the mountain, okay, where God, you know, answered the call, which was the burning bush incident. So again, you've got Meribah and Sinai, again, in the same region. There's some geographical proximity going on there. In Anchor Bible Dictionary, the writer says, examination of the text referring to Massah and Meribah shows that there was no unified tradition of what constituted the rebellion. So now they're going to go off into the sources and all that stuff. Let's see. Again, without getting lost in the source talk, the question is, could these things be harmonized for us? You know, that's the question for us, or maybe they're different incidents. Again, and you're going to have scholars on that side as well. The test that they were given involved water, obviously. Psalm 81 implies that all Israel was tested by the waters of Meribah. Then he's going to go, no, Deuteronomy 33, not so much. It looks like, you know, the priesthood was. So they're going back and forth. You know, and again, the question is, well, maybe these things can be reconciled. Maybe they're two different events that happen at the same place. I mean, again, you're going to have scholars take different positions here. Here's a key thought, though. Psalm 95, 8 through 11, and I'm going to click there, specifies that Israel was punished with 40 years of wandering in the desert for the sin of testing Yahweh at Meribah. But no details are supplied. Now, let me read that to you. I'm going to go back up to verse 6. O come, let us worship and bow down. This is Psalm 95, verse 6. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God. We are the people of his pasture, the sheep of his hand. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as on the day at Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test and put me to the proof, though they had seen my work. For 40 years, I loathed that generation and said, they are a people who go astray in their hearts, and they have not known my ways. Therefore, I swore in my wrath, and they shall not enter my rest. Now, that passage, I'm just going to give you my little take here. That passage doesn't specifically say that the 40 years punishment derived from or was caused by what happened at Massah and Meribah. I think the writer of Anchor Bible Dictionary might be reading that into it. But some scholars do make that argument. Okay, where else, if you remember our series in Hebrew, where did I suggest from other Psalms and from other passages, where did I say that when the writer of Hebrews says they're not going to enter into my rest and then references the Old Testament, anybody remember what incident the writer of Hebrews took us back to that was the catalyst for the wilderness wanderings? That was Numbers 13 and 14. And what was the failure? It was the report of 10 of the spies who went into the land and saw the Anakim, okay, the descendants of the Nephilim there. And they just quit. That happened at Kadesh. Okay, so you could, again, connect that incident with Meribah if you wanted to, because of they're both connected with Kadesh. So we have another passage, in this case, Psalm 95, that has some geographical proximity relationship between not only these place names now, but a specific incident that was the catalyst to the 40 years of wandering, and that just so happened to involve the vestiges of the giant clans. Now that is going to be part two, because Amalek is intimately connected with the giant clan stuff. We're going to get to that next time. So again, I'll telegraph it a little bit more. We're not done with this yet, but what I want you to see is that we've got a convergence, you know, a concatenation of place names that are regionally in relation to each other. Meribah, Massah, Kadesh, Rephidim, Paran, Seir, Edom, and Sinai. The ones that are known are not in Midian. They're just not. They're not on the right hand side of the right hand of the right prong of the Red Sea. They're not over there. They are on the other side. They're on the left hand side near the top. Okay, where again, Edom is known, Seir is known. For the fourth or fifth time now, if you have not listened to the March from the South episodes related to the location of Sinai, you just have to do that. Because that material typically gets skipped or glossed over, or nobody really kind of realizes like what that means in relation to discussing the location of Sinai. And here we have another one, Rephidim. So again, I just want you again to realize that while we can't determine these things with the kind of precision we'd like to have, you know, you can whittle away. You can whittle away at it. You can get rid of some options, or at least take some options and label them least likely or something like that, or less likely, you know. Now, again, let's go back to the Meribah Masa, you know, the Rephidim episode here, the incident in the first seven verses. Again, we now have this associated with the 40-year curse in some way by virtue of Psalm 95. What I'm suggesting is, okay, in some way, again, either we've got a couple of incidents at Kadesh / Rephidim / Masa Meribah. Maybe things happened at the same place at different times. Okay, maybe again, if you prefer the JEDP approach, well, these are different sources that are trying to put the events together. Again, whichever way you want to go, I mean, I don't think that view is called for. Again, and I'm in part because I think there are other weaknesses to the whole JEDB thing. I mean, I'm a little bit colored by that, but there are differences between them, and there can be different events. There's no rule against that. Because if they're, now catch this, if these places are regionally, again, close, you know, they're just within a few days of each other, you know, walking around, it is quite conceivable that you could have things happen at the same place or near the same place more than once. I mean, that there's nothing nonsensical about that. That's very possible. So, you know, what are we going to do with that? You know, and if we throw Deuteronomy 33 into it, the giving of the law, Sinai, at Meribah Kadesh, okay, you know, it's very possible. Again, these could have been way stations, and they were. We can tell this much from the itinerary. There were way stations on the way to Sinai. And they do have something to do with after Sinai, journeying to Canaan, and then failing, and then being sentenced to wander for 40 years. I mean, basically, they're kind of in the same area. They're just wandering around, you know, kind of in the Negev somewhere, you know, south of Canaan proper, because they're gonna emerge, you know, ultimately after 40 years, they're gonna go up the Transjordan from the south, and then cross over into Canaan, you know, during the days of Joshua. I mean, we know how this works, you know, roughly with the itinerary. Again, all of this can work, really, except for if you think you're in Midian, then you've got significant problems. And if we throw in the whole, you know, we spent part of an episode on this too, the whole 3 days journey language, in the mouth of Moses and Aaron and God himself, okay, in the burning bush incident in Exodus 4, you know, let my son go out into the wilderness 3 days and offer sacrifice to me. We know where the sacrifice happened. It happens at Sinai, okay? You know, do we take that literally? I mean, if it's 3 days, you know, then really all of the views of Sinai have a tough time. I mean, even the Kadesh Edom is like, boy, you'd really have to truck it for 3 days, you know, to have 3 days and get out there. You know, I mean, I guess you could make it, maybe. I mean, you know, it's 3 days. Maybe they had to sort of wait to catch their breath before they, you know, did what they're going to do. I mean, who knows? You know, you can quicken the pace dramatically and get there if you're going to take that 3 days literally. This is why some people will say Sinai is Har Karkom, which is a little bit short of some of these other places, again, but it's still to the south. But to get to Midian in that amount of time is impossible. It's just not feasible. So you have to sort of take the 3 days as not literal. Then you have to ask yourself, well, why does God and Moses, I mean, this is like four or five times they say this. What's the point? You know, you have to basically take that part of the itinerary not at face value, and then take other parts at face value. And again, that's there's no sin there. I mean, that's an interpretive strategy to do that. But I want to point out again that even if you quote unquote solve that problem, you've still got this agglomeration of place names all in the same region, but not Midian. Again, you've got a problem there. So I want to just read a couple of excerpts here from people who have taken this information these are commentators. I don't want to just say that some people say that we've got different incidents at the same places. You know, that's real. I mean, there are scholars who land there. So I don't want you to get the impression that I'm just saying that because I don't like JEDP. Again, I'm not a traditional Mosaic authorship guy, and I'm not a JEDPer. I'm something else, okay, something in the middle there. But Expositor's Bible Commentary, this is written by Walter Kaiser. Okay, Kaiser says this. This is his take, commenting about Massah and Meribah, this incident in Rephidim. This incident is not to be confused with a similar episode that comes near the conclusion of Israel's 40 years of journeying in Numbers 20. So this one, Exodus 17, is near the beginning. It's a few months. And then the other one is like 40 years later. Again, there are obvious differences here. The incident is not to be confused, again, with the one in Numbers 20. In this later account, the glory of the Lord is not present in that one, whereas he is in Exodus 17. And Moses is explicitly instructed that he is not to strike the rock, but only to speak to it. This shows that the only connections between Israel's need and God's supply was the divine word. True, they also named that place the waters of Meribah, Numbers 20:13. But the symmetry and naming may indeed be deliberate to emphasize the purpose in allowing the incidents and in directing that they be recorded as scripture. God's people are prone to grumbling at the first hint of adversity, no matter how abundant and spectacular may be the evidence of his power and presence. Let me just stop there. Basically, Kaiser's saying, look, they complained at both places, so both incidents, so the terminology is still appropriate. Back to Kaiser. Thus, the dual name brought out both the people's testing of God, Massah means to test, and quarreling, Meribah means contention or strife. In less than 6 months, they had witnessed 10 plagues, the pillar of cloud and fire, the opening and shutting of the Red Sea, the miraculous sweetening of the water, the sending of food and meat from heaven. And yet their real question came down to this, is the Lord among us? Like, duh, that's not in Kaiser, that's me. I mean, you have this string of events and you get to Exodus 17 and then their question is the Lord among us? Like, how clueless can you possibly be? And that was Kaiser. On the Jewish side, Casuto, let me quote him, he separates the incidents as well. An incident similar to this one, which took place at the outset of the Israelite itinerary, so in the wilderness, is depicted in another part of the Torah, Numbers 20, verses 1 through 11, dealing with the end of the wanderings. From the literary viewpoint, this provides an interesting example of the symmetry that the biblical style is fond of achieving by means of parallelism between the beginning and conclusion of its narrations. And from a thematic standpoint, we may see in this duplication the intention to substantiate emphatically the tradition concerning the providential care that the Lord gave to the needs of his people in the wilderness from the first to the last stage of their travels. So, Casuto is more or less making it either literary purely, but he also, again, recognizes the disconnect in the chronology and therefore, again, presumably the events. And he's saying, look, these two events are characterized, in very similar ways to create literary symmetry. Again, these are just examples. I just want you to know that, again, there are scholars who disagree on this, and it's really comes down to the authorship debate. But regardless of that, for our purposes, what I want you to get focused on, if you want to rabbit trail in these things, I throw them in sometimes because people are interested in issues like authorship. But for our purposes here, we want to pay attention to where these things in Exodus 17 happen. Again, this concatenation of place names that are associated with Sinai itself, the mountain. I'm going to read what Sarna says here from his Exodus commentary. The Rephidim is the last station on the journey from the Sea of Reeds to Sinai, according to Exodus 19:2 and Numbers 33:14 and 15. So those are the other itineraries. Its location is uncertain. Verse 6 in the present chapter shows that it must be very close to Horeb, Mount Sinai, but the identity of the latter is itself a matter of considerable scholarly controversy. Certainly, a wilderness station must be assumed to be an oasis. Why then was there no water at Rephidim? Unlike the situation at Marah in Exodus 15:23, that's the bitter waters, potability, again, the quality of the water, is not mentioned as a problem here. Therefore, either drought conditions had caused severe depletion of the usually available local resources, or the people were forcibly denied access to them. Let me just stop there. What Sarna is making an assumption here that any place that the great company of people would stop, they would only stop if there was a reason to stop, i.e. there was an oasis. There's food and water there. They stock up. And, you know, that makes sense. We're not actually told that, but, you know, there's some sense to that. And so Sarna goes from there, from that point of logic in his head, and says, well, you know, if it was a way station, why wasn't, you know, what's wrong? And he says, there's no mention that the water is bitter like at Mara. They just don't have it. So why don't they have it? So he says, either there was a drought and it was dried up, or there was some force there preventing them from getting to the water. And he opts for the last one because of what follows in Exodus 17. He says the latter choice, again, they were forcibly denied access to the water. He says the latter seems more plausible because it ties in with the next episode, verses 8 through 16. The hostile Amalekites were in control of this region and blocked the approaches to the sources of water. Again, that's the end of Sarna. So that's his take and how he sets up what's going to happen in, you know, in what follows. Now, you know, we can look at it and say, well, you know, okay, you know, that might be the case. It says Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. That's Exodus 17:8. It's very clear that there's a conflict. Something starts the conflict. But there's just more to it because of Amalek. And so next time, you know, we're going to get into verses 8 through 16. And the real question we're going to start with is, who are the Amalekites? Now, I'm going to seed some things to you so that you can be thinking about them, you know, for next week. So we first encountered the name Amalek in Genesis 36:12. All right? It's one of these boring genealogies. And if we've learned anything on this podcast to this point, it's that boring genealogies sometimes, in case many, many times, have some really interesting stuff in. So I'm going to read Genesis 36. I'm going to go back to verse 11, one verse prior, and here's what we read. The sons of Eliphaz were Timon, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz. Verse 12, and 12 is a parenthetical thought, or begins with a parenthetical thought. Timnah was a concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son. She bore Amalek to Eliphaz. And then it continues, these are the sons of Adah, Esau's wife. So we learn in this parentheses a few things. Timnah was a concubine of Eliphaz, who was Esau's son, whose own mother was Adah, who, if we go back up to Genesis 36:2, we read this. Esau took his wives from the Canaanites, Adah, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and then a few other women. So we learn that Adah was the daughter of Elon, quote-unquote, the Hittite. According to Genesis 36:20 and 22, Timnah was a Horite, H-O-R-I-T-E. Let me just read Genesis 36:20 and 22. These are the sons of Seir. There's a familiar name, familiar term. The Horite, the inhabitants of the land. Lotan, Shobal, Zibeon, Anah, Dishon, Ezer, and Dishon. These are the chiefs of the Horites, the sons of Seir in the land of Edom. Horites are in Seir and Edom. Okay. The sons of Lotan were Hori and Himam, and Lotan's sister was Timnah. Okay, so we learn from this that genealogy that Timnah, who was the concubine of Eliphaz, who was the son of Esau, okay, and Eliphaz's own mother was Adah, who was the daughter of the Hittites. We learn that Timnah was a Horite, one of the native population of Edom, and the Horites were a people group who lived in the hill country of Seir, according to Genesis 32:3, which says, Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. So Seir is a sub-geographical set of Edom. Seir was part of Edom. You say, well, who cares? Well, we have to ask ourselves, where do we get this grouping elsewhere? Edom, descendants of Esau, the Horites, Seir. You know, where do we get all that elsewhere? Deuteronomy 2. And if you've read Unseen Realm, that's going to be familiar. Deuteronomy 2, and I'm going to read, go back to verse, let's go here. Who's the speaker here? Okay, it's Deuteronomy, so we're going to have Moses here. And in verse 9, the Lord said to me, do not harass Moab or contend with them in battle. See that Moses is leading, you know, the Israelites up, you know, the Transjordan here. Do not harass Moab or contend with them in battle, for I will not give you any of their land for a possession, because I have given Ar to the people of Lot for a possession. Verse 10, the Amim formerly lived there, a people great and many, and tall as the Anakim. Like the Anakim, they are also counted as Rephaim, but the Moabites call them Amim. The Horites also live in Seir formerly. They lived there formerly. But the people of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from, you know, from the place where they had settled, as Israel did to the land of their possession, which the Lord gave to them. Now rise, go up, go over to the brook of Zered. So we went over to the brook of Zered at the time from our leaving Kadesh Barnea until we crossed the brook of Zered was 38 years. So they've gone full circle. Began at Kadesh, and they've ended there, and then they go across. Again, we know the familiar story here. But the Horites are mentioned in Deuteronomy 2, verse 12, along with the Amim and the Anakim and the Rephaim. Isn't that interesting? If we go keep reading in Deuteronomy 2, we get down to verse 20, and we read this, talking about, again, Ammon in this case, the place Ammon. It is also counted as a land of Rephaim. Rephaim formerly lived there, but the Ammonites called them Zamzumim, a people great and many, and tall as the Anakim, but the Lord destroyed them before the Ammonites, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place, as he did for the people of Esau, who lived in Seir, when he destroyed the Horites before them. Now, did you catch the parallelism there? Who are the destroyed them of verse 21? The Zamzumim, the Anakim, you know, the one or the Rephaim. And who are the destroyed them in verse 22? It's the Horites. Now, this is consistent with Genesis 14, verse 6. This is, you know, the five kings against the four kings and all that, the Kedor Laomer, you know, passage, which I do not talk about in Unseen Realm, but we're going to get into next week. In the 14th year, Kedor Laomer and the kings who were with him came and defeated the Rephaim and Ashtaroth Karnaim and the Zuzim and Ham, the Amim and Shaveh Kiriathaim and the Horites in their hill country of Seir, as far as El Paran on the border of the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to En Mishpat, that is, Kadesh, and defeated all the country of the Amalekites, and also the Amorites, who were dwelling in Hazazon Tamar. And of course, we know from Amos 2, 9, and 10 that the Amorites were tall as cedars. You see the picture emerging here. I mean, we've already gone to Numbers 13. That's the famous Nephilim Anakim passage. Just look at that. I can't help but go to Numbers 13. There's 26 through 23, and especially, you know, 28 to 33. It's 26 to 33, and there's a lot packed into this. Pay attention here to especially to verses 28 and 29. So it says, however, the people who dwell in the land, again, this is the bad report from the spies. The people who dwell in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And besides, we saw the descendants of Anak there. And then you get the grocery list. Amalekites dwell in the land of the Negev, the Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites dwell in the hill country, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea along the Jordan. And then you go down to verse 33. We saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim. And we seem to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seem to them. Where does that incident take place? Numbers 13, 26. And they came to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the people of Israel in the wilderness of Paran. Can you believe that? Paran. Deuteronomy 33, Paran is where Sinai. Paran at Kadesh. Numbers 13:26 actually says that the failure with the giant clans occurs in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They're right back into it. When you hit, again, the incident in Exodus 17 with the Amalekites from verses 8 through 16, it's the same area. It's also where Sinai, I mean, can you believe this? The place where they fail because of the giant clans, this region is peppered, sprinkled, again, with more of these people. Now, there had been a lot more of them in the past, you know, because the descendants of Esau and Ammon and Moab, you know, they've wiped out the Amim and the Zuzim and the Zamzumim, and the Horites are always mentioned with them, with those other groups. And you know, interestingly enough, Amalek's mom was a Horite. So that's what we got going there. Again, it's cosmic geographical stuff that you wouldn't necessarily pick up on unless you're looking back and looking at some of the genealogies and some of these place names and they, you know, how they sort of conglomerate together. The Amalek incident occurs in the same vicinity as the later failure of Numbers 13 and 14, which is the catalyst of the 40 years wandering. Now, Moses and Joshua here, think about this. Moses and Joshua are going to defeat the Amalekites, whose lineage goes back to the Horites, one of the people associated with the giant clans. We don't have the giants specifically mentioned in Exodus 17 unless you count the Horites. That they're, again, in that people group, there's some of these because they're always mentioned with the other ones. All the way back to Genesis 14. Look at the list. You've got Rephaim, this is from verse 5 to verse 7. Rephaim, Zuzim, Amim, and the Horites in the country of Seir, the hill country of Seir. And the hill country is a big deal too, because when you actually get into the conquest accounts, these the places where you get the killing language, again, to target the Anakim, is typically in the hill country. And these things overlap. These things overlap, and they have relationships to each other. Amorites, Amalekites, Horites. Again, the other ones sort of get more press because, you know, we think for some reason that they're the ones specifically associated with the Rephaim and the Anakim. They really all are. All of these subgroups. So, I mean, it tells you that among these people groups, in these geographical areas or this you know wide geographical region, you know, both south of Canaan and then in the Transjordan on the other side. This is where all this action takes place. And we have all of these common associations. And here's the surprise. Sinai is somewhere in the middle of that because of these geographical place names. Again, it's just, I mentioned it before, you can't get This you can't get all this stuff. It's not just one or two things that you got to somehow get it over into Midian. You got to get all of this in Midian. And I don't know how you're going to do that. I mean, there's more going on than just one or two place names. It's all of this activity and this action. And Kadesh is known. Seir is known. Edom is known. Lots of the other places aren't, but there are some that are. And Sinai is somewhere in the middle of all this stuff. Doesn't that set up the giving of the law, the fact that God is camped out in the middle of this? I mean, it just adds another layer to the whole series of confrontations. God essentially going into a place that he's been cleaning house there before Moses and the Israelites ever get there. He's using other descendants of Abraham to do the job. And again, if you've read Unseen Realm, you know that this is ultimately about God's victory over chaos. And the victory over chaos is intimately associated with Babel and Babylon. And not coincidentally, it's not only what happens in Genesis 11 that's connected to Babel, it's also what happens in Genesis 6 that's connected to Babel. Again, it's a matrix of ideas. I mean, how many times have I said that? You have a matrix of ideas that are at work running underneath the surface of these sorts of things. And so where does God put his own place? Right in the middle of that, because he's going to do away with it. He's going to clean house. He's going to establish his beachhead right in the middle of this stuff. That's where he's going to begin his, you know, to make new, to revive, to make alive again his presence on earth. I mean, think Eden. Again, the kickstarting Eden, a phrase I use in Unseen Realm a lot. This is where he decides to do it. This is the beachhead right here. And then he's going to move with the people from Sinai into Canaan. And what was cleaned up in the Sinai region, again, Seir, Edom, Paran, Kadesh, Rephidim, all this, that's just going to move. That's just going to migrate into Canaan proper. And the Israelites are supposed to do the same thing there. Get rid of the vestiges of the Babel chaos. That's what you're here for. And this is where we are going to start, you know, the next installment, the next phase of salvation history, to restore Eden and unify what was lost, what was disinherited at Babel. Again, all these Babylonish connections mean something, but we often don't notice them. And again, we'll flesh this out, you know, next time in part two. It's just cool stuff. Okay. I mean, I don't want to run down the road too far at just to set this up, but next time in part two, we're going to devote a full episode to this. We'll get into Genesis 14 again, which I did not, you know, include in Unseen Realm. We're going to get into that. We're going to get into these people group names, and then we'll take a look at what happens again in the conflict with Amalek. But there's a lot that's just lurking under the surface here.
Mike, I need some kind of visual reference to go through all this stuff. It starts blending together. We need to produce some kind of visual aid or something.
A mic and a whiteboard.
Something. So you can get lost here pretty easily. But you start talking about the hill country and all this stuff, and this is where we're actually going to Israel. You know, I start visualizing some of the terrain. I know it's not the exact location, but it helps at least visualize some of the stuff, places you're talking about. But yeah, we need some kind of visual guide to help us with all this stuff.
I guess we can stick a map on the episode page for now and just say, hey, look at that while you're listening. But, you know, I hear you.
All right. It's good stuff. Looking forward to part two. Don't forget to go get your tickets at nakedbibleconference.com. If you haven't done so, we hope to see you there. And with that, Mike, I just want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.